UA meeting, October 25th, 2006.
Okay, we've waited long enough for stragglers, so I'm going to call the meeting to order. We have a bit of a problem in that we don't have a quorum. I see the Professor Walcott, the Dean of Faculty, is smiling, having faced this probably many times. But there may be ways around at least a couple of those things, since I'm not sure that a couple of orders of business actually need to be voted on and have a simple majority. I'm not sure that we have to have a quorum to do that, but I'll think more about that. There should be a sheet going around, if you could sign your name, that in fact you were here. There's also, Amy has a sheet that should have current addresses, phone numbers, emails, all of that. If you could update that, that would be greatly appreciated. You all have copies of the minutes from the last meeting. Any corrections? Any? Yes? Aha. Maybe we just wished you were here. That's okay, so we will make that correction to the minutes.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Opal was not here at the last meeting.
Okay.
So I suggest we... Leon?
How many more people do we need for a quorum? Couple or...?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. We need... three more people.
Oh. In case if they walk in during the meeting.
Well, if they walk in there, that's fine. But so, do I hear any problem with approving the minutes? And I think we're just going to go ahead and approve them with the correction that Opal was not here, although she was here in spirit. You've had the opportunity to look over the agenda. Ah, Henry is here. We're closer to a quorum. Had you had a chance to look over the minutes, Henry?
Print them out, but I can't say that I...
Okay, that's fine. Maybe if you want to give them a quick peruse, we're just about to approve the minutes. Okay. Hearing nothing to the contrary, the minutes are approved. Anything by way of a late addition to the agenda? Anybody have anything they want to add? Randy?
I just want to say, I looked through the Krauss report, and I think it is important to put on an agenda because it seems to me that it transfers all our responsibilities for looking at the campus code to the university policy office.
Yeah, actually, that academic integrity sort of really is the Krauss report, and that's bundled into the discussion under new business of academic integrity. Okay, then let's move to announcements and reports. The chairs have met, and as a result of our meetings, we certainly did discuss the ramifications of the Krauss report, and we will talk about that under new business as part of a general discussion. You also have before you a document that's a discussion document on proposed charter changes, which is also under new business. And in essence, that is what your chairs have been involved with since the last meeting. So let's move to CJC. There was a meeting of the CJC convened yesterday by myself. The first order of business was the election of Kathleen Bork as continuing chair of the CJC. And the main topic, there were actually two. The first had to do with the impact, again, of the Krauss report on the CJC, and a general discussion as to whether the CJC should endeavor to do anything in light of the fact that the CJC may cease to exist if the Krauss report is implemented. Now, maybe now is the time. Are there people here who don't know about the Krauss report? Okay. That's fine. Other orders of business are in the attachments. They are there as two resolutions, which we will get to under business of the day. Otherwise, that was all that happened in the CJC. GPSA?
Yeah, GPSA had a meeting yesterday, had a couple resolutions which they went over. The first one was dealing with TAC, with all the changes to the university, parking. And so they sent a resolution just saying the GPSA disapproves of the changes that have been made, particularly to graduate student parking, and with the TGI survey from TAC. The other resolution that they passed dealt with Hasbrook, with the whole Hasbrook controversy, and that is going to be folded into a larger report, which is going to deal with a graduate student housing initiative, which is going to be coming from them, hopefully within the next month or so. Those are the two main things that came out of GPSA.
The main controversy was the Hasbrook, the transfer student
housing? Yes. Okay. That and there's some other issues about the graduate students want to create their own kind of community, much like the undergrads are trying to do. And so that might be some of the impetus for it, but there's a couple other issues in addition to that.
S.A.?
Okay, hi, my name's Adam Day. I haven't had the chance to meet a lot of you guys yet, but I'm one of the liaisons from the student assembly along with Kate. We do a lot of internal today with the student assembly about the organization and charter over the last 2 weeks. And also last Thursday, President Corson met with us and we discussed a lot of different issues, including the purview of the SA. And we also, throughout the 2 hour discussion, touched on a lot of issues like Hasbrook and the assembly. Future, in addition to the College Town and Capital campaign. Upcoming issues that we're going to be dealing with, one thing that Kate and I are going to be meeting with Cornell Store in the next week or two is about, and we'll also be bringing that here hopefully by the next meeting, is trying to have them publish the ISBN numbers of textbooks along with the title and author, because many students complain that sometimes when you go online and try to search for a textbook, it's tough to find which is the correct edition because then there's multiple editions. And so it just seems, I mean, it wouldn't be that much of an inconvenience, we don't think. So I thought we were going to meet with Marge Whitelander, I believe her name is, and just see if it would be reasonable for them to publish the ISBN number. So it would allow students just to quickly go online, Amazon, whatever, and just type in the ISBN, and there wouldn't be any mistakes about which edition. So that's something we're also dealing with for the next couple of weeks, and then hopefully we can bring that up here. Because I believe that Cornell Square falls under this assembly's purview. Mm-hmm. So that's something we can look forward to next month. Mm-hmm. I mean, that we will have to pass a resolution. Hopefully that we can just discuss with them implementing that and then go ahead. So just in case. See how that goes.
Anything else from the SA? Employee assembly? Do you have anything to say, Leon?
What we're working on basically is employees taking vacation or not taking vacation time. And a report that was based on a series of open forums that we call Chili Chat last academic year. A report is being put together to present to Mary George Opperman and other administrators regarding staff taking vacation.
Any other reports? Committee reports? Okay. Then we can move on to five business of the day. We still do not have a quorum. However, we really need to let these people know about their appointment to the Hearing and Review Board. As you know, one of the things that we are responsible for is ensuring that the hearing and review boards are staffed at an adequate level. And the CJC put forward the names of four people who were past members and would therefore be continuing reappointed members to the judicial board, and also one person who would be a fallback, basically on the standby list. My feeling is that we appoint them and worry about, you know, bringing it up when there's a quorum later, unless I cannot remember a time in the 8 years that I've been on this body when this has not just been rubber stamped. I will not do it if I hear anything to the contrary from voting members. Otherwise, I will let the CJC know that this slate is in fact approved, so that the people can be informed that they are in fact members of the pool for the boards. As to whether or not this is brought, I write a letter on behalf of the UA and send it to the president for his endorsement. I really want to read the charter and see what it says about our ability, what we need to do as far as voting to appoint somebody to the hearing board. I have a feeling that we will probably need a real quorum, and I will try to do that by email, if that is okay with you, before I send a letter off to the president. Does that meet with your requirements? Okay.
I just have a question.
Mm-hmm.
In the first sentence, where it says, whereas the University of UA is empowered to select student and non-faculty staff, is it possible to delete the word non-faculty and just say and staff?
Sure. Yeah, there's no reason to do that, to not do that. I should point out that Ari wrote this, and I thought he did a good job. I will remove that. That may have come right out of the charter, but I see no reason why that cannot be removed. So it would just be students and staff. With that done, we can move on to the discussion of academic integrity. And in essence, this really brings up the issue of the Krauss report and the impact that it has on how the UA interacts with the campus code, which is at present. I should have taken notes. The JA was at the CJC meeting yesterday. This is great. JA, CJC. This is really wonderful. Yeah, I mean, who knows that it's going to, except that's smoking. We don't do that anymore. But you're showing that when they used to have cigarette ads on TV, this is bad. And there were a couple of things that came out of the discussion. The first, of course, was whether or not President Skorton is in fact aware of the Krauss report. And according to Mary Beth, the JA, when she talked to him in September, he knew of the report, but he had not looked it over at all. And her impression was that because of the announcement of the campaign and everything that led up to the campaign, that in fact he has not read it. Now, this, I could be wrong, perhaps.
You're quite correct.
So, in a way, we're not really sure what his feelings are about the Krauss report and its implementation. There was quite a bit of discussion at the CJC concerning whether it was an all or nothing kind of decision to be made. There were a number of aspects of the recommendation. Some of them had to do with a more administrative aspects, that is, moving the entire code enforcement, if we can call it that, parts of the code to a new office under the Dean of Students. But not necessarily removing the University Assembly from having input to that. It really depends upon how you name things and how you move things around. It's also possible that you could alter the academic integrity code to make it more readable, which is one of the goals, and simplify the code. There was a question of changing it into something more parental and less judicial. There was this feeling that the code all along has read too much like a law book and like the penal statutes, as opposed to having this educational feel to it. Basically, the idea of one of the members, I think it's, I don't remember who it was, that basically you bring a student and spank them and tell them they've been bad and send them off in the hopes that they won't do it again, as opposed to treating them like criminals, which basically means they need attorneys and you have an entire process there for hearings and reviews and the like. So in terms of where academic integrity stands as regards the Krauss report, it's really up in the air. And we have decided, at least the CJC has decided, to continue as if we are not changing anything and get on with filling the hearing board, making changes as necessary to the code. There will be an item brought forward at the next meeting concerning surreptitious videotaping, which apparently is not covered specifically in the code. For those of you who aren't aware of how the code works, it's rather like how the NBA makes rules. You wait for something to happen, you know it's wrong, you try to find an existing statute that covers it. If there isn't something specific, you find something close, and then you go back and you write something that is more specific. And if, in fact, you've looked at the code, you'll see there's a whole list. We're actually into the AAs and ABs and ACs, having already gone through the regular alphabet. And this has grown as infractions come about. You were going to say something about video taping?
Well, I could.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Yeah, you're safe. You're not handled through the JA. So. Campus
pick,
code.
Pick on
camera. So, basically, that's where the CJC stands, our committee, relative to the issue of academic integrity. What wasn't clear was whether or not we should continue our discussions on honor codes and aspects of academic integrity that were brought forward by President Lehman when he was here, or whether we should just forget about that and pretend it never happened and just get on with life. Because there are other models besides the Krauss report, and there is a general feeling that the Code of Academic Integrity as it exists right now is not as good as it could be. Okay. So basically, how do we feel about that? Do you have anything to say, Dean of Student of Faculty?
Well, yeah, I have a couple of things to suggest. I don't mean in any way to dictate to anybody, but it strikes me that you have the situation where you have the Krauss report, and that it might make a lot of sense for this body to at least look at that and see if there are pieces of that that you think are an improvement over the current arrangement. Because while it is true the President has not read it, has not thought about it, and so on, this is, seems to me, a wonderful time to make a slightly preemptive strike, you might say, and offer a counter-proposal, if you don't like it. The basic message that Barb was given was that she was to draft a code which was aspirational rather than a list of thou shalt not, including videotaping people, but that it was to be turned around and be positive in nature. And that strikes me as a reasonable kind of thing to do. And I think maybe the assemblies would like to say that's a wonderful idea. The second issue is this whole reporting relationship and so on, and it strikes me as unreasonable to leave out the CJC as having something to do with it, but maybe a different role. So I would urge the group to think about this because I think this is a moment when decisions have not been made and your input could be taken very seriously. I would also separate the code of conduct from academic integrity. I think they are related, but they're different. And so I would not try and muddle those two together. And I would talk about the code of conduct, and I would talk about academic integrity, and I would put a kind of a barrier between those two things.
I should mention, you reminded me, we discussed the idea of examining the code as something the UA could do. And in addition, something that is not discussed within the context of a report, but is something that will obviously need to be done, is to gather information from all of all constituencies regarding the Krauss report and anything we might do. This might be in the form of forums like we did for parking, dealing with actually going to the SA and the GPSA and whatever, and presenting proposals that we might have, discussions. In other words, being, as you say, proactive as opposed to being reactive, realizing that in the absence of a decision, the code is ours. Okay? We have the code. And I think that any changes that are to be made would be better coming from us proactively as opposed to waiting and being reactive, assuming that the president decides to do anything about it anyway.
And sorry, just also, you guys all know the executive committee sent a letter to President Scorton just about the Krauss report, trying to figure out where his stance on it is. So that was mailed off
last week. And I haven't heard back.
Well, I guarantee you won't hear anything until next week at the very earliest. He's
kind of
busy, right?
Yeah, I didn't really expect to get an instant reply back. I even sent a snail mail to him, although I copied us email, figuring that we wouldn't hear anything back before the next meeting. But I think you raise a very good point. Now, in terms of academic integrity, my understanding is there's going to be a new office that deals specifically with academic integrity, at least for faculty. Somebody was telling me about all of the new offices that are going to be stuck over in the new building they're putting up over on behind East Hill. And under Office of Sponsored Programs, there was going to be some kind
of an
research office.
That's the Office of Research Integrity.
Oh, it's Research Integrity. I'm sorry.
Maya Crook and Human Subjects.
Okay.
And all that.
I'm sorry.
IBC and so on.
I obviously got that wrong. Henry?
Well, a couple of things. One, being more kind of reconstructed, under academic integrity, we can certainly comment, but if not, isn't it the faculty covers the process and everything else in the academic integrity?
Sure, but I think it's very important in thinking about the issue to have a discussion in a broad constituency. And I know of no other organization that has representatives of faculty, students, and staff, where one can start such a discussion and have a dialogue as to what it might make sense to do. Do honor code work, for example. Is that something we, as a group, and then as a university, should think about or not? And the vet school has one, for instance, as well, so it's the law school. And so in that sense, that's why I think this is the right group to begin that kind of discussion. And yes, the faculty senate, I think, has the final jurisdiction on those kinds of things, but I don't think you ought to be restrained by that.
I think that after Dean Walcott came and talked to us last time, this is something that has definitely piqued my interest with regards to the academic code of integrity, because it has been written and looked at mainly by the Faculty Senate and without really any regards for students' voice within it. And I see the code as more of a communication point between faculty and students, and currently it's not. And I don't think that the standards and expectations of the code have been communicated correctly to a lot of students. And I think that that's something that we should evaluate across all constituencies and starting in this in the university assembly and have increased communication between the student assembly, GPSA, and GPSA, and also faculty and also staff as well, because it affects a lot of administrative staff that deals with the academics as well. And I think that it definitely is something that needs to be realistic, because I don't think there's effective communication at all or any awareness on the student's aspect of right now. And I don't necessarily think that it's too much of a judicial issue, but I just don't think that the expectations and standards that come off of the academic code are communicated correctly. And I think that that needs to become increasingly aware. And I think that, I mean, if we were to look at possibly creating kind of a committee or something along those lines to really look at this deeply over the next year or so and make an effective change with it, I think that that's something we can definitely take on. And that's something, I mean, I personally would be really interested in seeing happen. So that's just my own personal view on the academic code, because I think it's an extremely important body that governs the relationships between all the constituencies of the Green University.
Well, I was going to say, it's not just academic imperatives, I guess, that we're looking at that needs to be communicated to the rest of the university. I mean, when we were talking about this last year, we talked about putting on forms and making sure that we did not just go out to the public and say, surprise, we changed the code. And so I think it's something, in addition to academic integrity, while currently the current code may not be as well communicated, that any changes we need to get a community input from, whether it's through forms, whether it's through surveys, what have you. Like, we need to be in constant communication and making sure the public has, like, even if we first assess the Krauss report, decide what changes we want to make from there, any of those changes that we decide upon, like presenting maybe our revised version of the Krauss report to the community and getting their feedback, because maybe they agreed with the original Krauss report or what they agree with the changes that we're making, or they're seeing things that we haven't even thought of.
But I think with regards to the academic code and the code of conduct, there's two, like you said, it's some two completely separate things we need to look at. And I think the campus code of conduct.
Dean Walcott.
Yeah. And I think the campus code of conduct is going to be something that is a much larger issue that's going to happen and effectively change over the course of a couple of years, where the academic integrity code is something that we can actually look at now and make an effective change on. So I think that that's something maybe we should consider first looking at, and seeing if we can actually make a change on it, and then kind of moving to a great, bigger, a broader code.
You know, I agree with what everyone just said, except because we don't know what the president may or may not do with the Krauss report and when he may or may not do it. So I don't know if we have the luxury of waiting another entire academic year before we come up with something. So I would just hope that we could do something in a more timely manner before this academic year is over. I mean, is there any way we can, I guess we just have to wait to hear from him. There's no way we can find out what action, if any, he's going to take or...
My guess is that if the university assembly says this is something we want to discuss, think about, that the president will respect that. That seems to be very much his style.
Okay. And I think we should remember that the issue of the code and changes to the code and issues of academic integrity are something that were discussed here in the UA before President Skorton, before President Lehman was here. This is an ongoing issue. The perception of the code, remembering, of course, that there are two parts to the code, okay, and I want to make sure we were talking about the right thing. There's REMPO, okay, which are the regulations for the maintenance of public order. Okay. And those are really the ones about, you know, theft and stealing and all of that. Then there is REMI, okay, the regulations for the maintenance of the educational environment. And I think that's what you're talking about in terms of where academic integrity issues fall more under REMI than REMPO. REMPO is the kind of thing that the campus police carry around with them and use for alcohol abuse and things like that. REMI is very different. But certainly, I agree with you, Leon, and certainly we have no plans within the CJC, speaking for the CJC, to just sit by and let things happen. The Krauss report is a good springboard to use, but even if President Skorton looked and said, well, yes, I really like the Krauss report, there would still have to be implementation procedures. The entire office structure would have to be determined. I mean, the nuts and bolts were not in the Krauss report.
But I just want to caution that we don't want to be reactive after some decisions have been made, perhaps, that we're in a reactionary mode instead of a proactive mode. That's the only point I was trying to make.
Yeah, no, I think that the formation of a committee to look at the Krauss report, look at the entire issue, and report back to us on their views. We already have the CJC that will be working on it as well. And I don't think that we should necessarily wait to see what the president has planned, because there are things that are broken that need to be fixed no matter what the president decides on doing. Is that sort of what you were thinking?
I mean, not so much on focusing on the Krauss report, because I think that, I mean, the Krauss report mainly deals with the campus code of conduct, correct?
It also has some philosophical aspects to it as well, as to how you view the code. And issues of academic integrity are something else. And I'm not sure that I even have it clear in my mind how you exactly separate those two. I mean, I could give examples of them, but in a code sense, I'm not 100% clear in my own mind. I need some clarification. Maybe do you have a clearer picture of how you separate the two?
Yeah, I do. Because, for example, it's the what group adjudicates these matters, and by and large, it's the faculty group that adjudicates the matters of academic integrity and that whole arena of things. We had a meeting this morning of all the academic integrity committees throughout the university. They never talk to one another, so I convene an annual meeting where they can compare notes. And it turns out to be very interesting, because it turns out that most of the problems are the same in the various colleges, and they break down to cheating on examinations, plagiarism. Those are the two main problems that we face. I would add other kinds of things to that issue, which are proper use of medical excuses and so on, that there ought to be a limit on the number of grandparents that are allowed to die in a defined period of time in order to avoid dissemination. You're not allowed more than 10 grandparents per customer. You know, those kinds of things are really academic issues, and they are considered by the academic side of the house. Both students and faculty are on the academic hearing boards. And that is distinct, then, from the Code of Campus Conduct, which has a whole other series of things that it says you shall or shall not do. And so I think they're separate, but they are also matters of concern to a broad constituency.
So I guess where I can reach is within REMI, there are a number of statutes, if I can call them that, dealing, for example, it is considered an infraction of the code if you do anything that advances your academic position relative to other students. Okay? So if you go and you look at a microscope, get what you want, and then move the slide, okay, that is actually breaking the code. It's not just an academic integrity issue. So there are parts of the code that directly address issues specific to academic integrity, although these days I think it's handled, as you say, by faculty committees or committees within the separate colleges as opposed to the JA.
But I see that as more of behavioral kind of confinement, or kind of look at the behavior of students. Whereas I kind of view the academic code of integrity as more just a communications of expectations and standards between faculty and students. And I think that, you know, it's more punishment focused in the code of conduct, rather than the academic code of integrity is more governing the relationship and the expectations between the two constituencies. And it brings in the employees as well and staff. And I think that is important, because I think we need to just relook at that, in order to increase the communication and expectations between the two. But I think that there's a lacking right now.
Well, I think it's certainly within the, I won't say purview of the UA, but it's certainly something that the UA should look at and certainly provide input, you know, come up with resolutions, whatever, pass them on. There may be parts of it that, in fact, impact the code. Where it exists is separate. That we talk, for example, about having contracts that students sign, of which basically lists code violations of academic integrity and basically saying, you know, you won't do that. In a lot of the laboratories that we run up in the vet school, my own undergraduate laboratory, you know, the students are told in writing reports that there's this expectation. We actually have them sign something. I understand that there are, during exams, people who sign the blue book on the inside, which states that you didn't cheat.
But I think that those ways of approaching it are not necessarily effective, because students just signing their name at the bottom of paper, they're not actually understanding what the code and the expectations are. And I think that maybe on this, you know, assembly, we can get a little bit more creative in the ways that we actually communicate and create those venues of communication between the two of them. And so maybe those are things that we can look through, and especially as the UA, because we kind of bring together all the constituencies, have the opportunity to do that. And I think that we definitely have, you know, a chance to do that this year.
I know you've been very very into this topic. So what were some of the ideas you had in which the university assembly could approach this, since I know you've been...
Because we are, you know, assembly that brings everyone together, and so it's more just kind of getting a feel for where all the constituencies stand on this issue, and what their view on it is, and then kind of bring that together to see what changes we can make. I mean, even, you know, possibly, this is just an idea, you know, I possibly had is, you know, if you have, like, the freshman writing seminars, for example, so every freshman coming in or every grad student coming in their first assignment has to write a one-page, you know, short assignment on the code or something along those lines that really just kind of embeds it within them and makes them more aware of what the expectations are.
Something that forces people to at least acknowledge.
Actually, at least think about it. And think about it and not just on a piece of paper. And, you know, thinking in those terms, and maybe, but I think first we need to do a little bit of research and get points of view in order to do that.
I definitely understand that. And also, like, I know coming at it from arts and sciences point of view, with their peer advising program, one of the deans will come in and talk with all the advisors about it, and then we have to talk about it with all of our freshmen when during orientation weeks, and maybe making sure that, I don't know, whichever other colleges do peer advising programs, or making all the, initiating... where all the colleges do peer advisor programs, where you have to go over academic integrity.
We're working through systems that are already in place.
Right, exactly. Enhancing them.
I want to say something about the Krauss report and related to academic integrity. My feeling is they shouldn't be so separate. But I thought the Krauss report, in terms of the thou shalt part, was really excellent. Really excellent. And here's an example where I thought it just came to the doorstep of academic integrity, but didn't include academic integrity. So in the conduct code draft, page 5E, it sort of says, to be honest and truthful in dealings with or on behalf of the university, this precludes, among other things, and it has three things, falsely or deceptively presenting one's own identity, like social security number or Cornell card number. Two, dishonesty or deception in the procurement or use of university or other records and documents, including identification cards, licenses, and permits. And three, falsely or deceptively representing one's university status or authority to represent the university using Cornell letterhead or stuff like that. And then the fourth one, which isn't there, would be like not cheating on tests or things like that. And it just seemed like it made the code of conduct complete by adding a sentence there on academic integrity. And there was a few places within the report that I found that to be true, or I thought it would be better if it included academic integrity. With saying that, I also want to say my feeling of the purpose of the Krauss report, which I remember Leon said, when somebody changes the code, there's an underlying reason. And if you were to take an SAT and you had the three following things, you had to group the two together. Rape, not leaving a building when there was a fire drill, and civil disobedience. Which two would you group together?
the Krauss report groups rape and not leaving a building when there's a fire drill together, and civil disobedience has a whole section of its own.
Not obeying the TCAP
driver. Not obeying the TCAP drivers. Yeah. So I think this report was made so the president, whoever that may be, would have the ultimate authority but absolutely no responsibility when it comes to dealing with civil disobedience. And I think my personal feeling, that's the underlying reason for the change in the code. So there's a lot of things that I think need to be changed about the Krauss report for that reason. But in terms of the thou shalt things, I think it's really wonderful. And including academic integrity to it may be an easy place to start and deal with two different issues.
Relative to that, what you really just described is the reason why there are two parts to the current code. Because REMI, okay, really deals with civil disobedience and the like, because that's considered an educational environment, although it crosses over into maintenance of public order that there's a difference between the part that's civil disobedience and the part that says we're going to build a shanty town behind Day Hall. That covered both of them, okay, but there were different aspects of that particular outpouring of civil disobedience, if I can call it that, where you could bring some people up under REMI and some people up under REMPO. In talking with Barbara when she was gathering information for this report, there were several things that she realized from having been JA and knowing the code very well that had to be taken into account. One thing she was concerned about, which isn't directed exactly what you said, had to do with the extent to which the code covered faculty. Should the code cover faculty? Okay, because there are other mechanisms that cover us, okay, that don't necessarily apply to everybody else. And the second was to remember that should the code deal with academic issues that rightfully belong to the faculty? It brought to mind something that the former dean of the vet school said when he was having arguments about merging departments. And he said, the academic program belongs to the faculty. Everything else belongs to me. I'll run the place the way I want to, administratively, and I'll decide what's going to happen and what departments are going to be there. But the academic program is purely yours. What you teach, how you teach it is purely yours. And there was this question about who has responsibility for academic integrity issues. And I think that she may not have moved into the area of actually taking what many consider to be the property of the faculty and essentially removing that from parts of the code. And I had this long talk with her about it. I'm not sure that was really what was in her mind, but certainly she knew about that. Henry?
I know in the present meeting, first talking about the code, that, you know, there are, I think, I've looked at the UVR code, and it speaks of the academic and conduct. So the UVR honor code that merged both is very simple, but easy to understand. But I also know that there's been gene scandals at UVA and everything else. So this is one of the things that President Lehman sort of wanted us to look at, was sort of saying, well, would an honor code work here? Would we want an honor code that would cover both conduct and academics and everything else? And I think that, in general, no, we shouldn't divide to be only reactive. I don't think it makes much sense to, you know, plow ahead with something and find out that the president is going to appoint some committee to do something else in connection to Krauss report. To the extent we at least find out what his process may be and say, okay, we would like to hold hearings on academic integrity, on a code, on a Krauss report. And in fact, if you're willing to give us, you know, a person in the administration or something else to go forward, then we can sort sense for us to go forward and find out these unions do something we saw. So I think at least wait a little bit and find out. I know the campaign is being announced tomorrow, but at least if we can find out what the, you know, what the process is. Because in fact, I mean, I remember asking Bob Krause this last year, depending on which title of the code that is in the report that part of it has to be passed by the trustees, only the trustees, and part of it obviously can be done by the UA. So the other question was, if we do change the code, who actually has to approve it? You know, there's certain parts that only the trustees can change. And so, you know, we can say what we want to, but we can't change that part. So, at least maybe starting to increase, maybe through the executive meetings, at least to sort of try to find out what the process will be, and even suggest the process. Suggest that we would have certain members of this committee, we'd be willing to act on the committee, and to go forward, because the crowd portfolio wasn't intended to be sort of hopefully passed within a short period of time. It's a starting point, and then we can suggest the next steps to go forward.
Yeah, I'm just speaking for myself, and since I'm chair, I get to do this. And those of you who remember discussions about the charter know that I'm inherently a troublemaker, and I will tell you now that the code is ours right now by charter approved by the trustees. And no president is going to have any committee dealing with the code that does not involve us directly. I will tell you that now. I will marshal all of us to go and sit in his office. This is not going to be taken away from us. We will not be ignored as long as the trustees have approved the charter that gives us the code. I'm not going to be adversarial at the start, but, you know, the code right now is ours, okay? And I'm not willing to give that up and just be dictated to in terms of what the future of our involvement is. To that extent, we will be proactive, and I'm sure that the president is not just going to ignore us. But the idea that he would somehow come up with a committee that bypassed us, I'm sure that it's been done many times, and in fact, it's done all the time, which is one of the reasons that this particular body has been emasculated of many of the things that were originally given to it by charter. But the code right now is ours. And unless, as I say, if the trustees want to take it away from us, you know, you can fight it, but to just go around us and ignore us, I will not allow to happen, personally.
I'm not suggesting that the president go around us. I'm just suggesting that...
No, but I mean, I think that this is justification for us to be proactive in what we did.
Just ask a question. The Krause report, I only saw like a month ago, but it existed for months before that. I suspect that the faculty in my department probably I'm the only one that knows it exists. Is the dissemination of this something we can do or not? It's not our report in the sense that Hunter Rollins said, make me a report. So actually, what's the status of this?
It has not been disseminated, but I was told authoritatively that the JA asked specifically about the report, and she was told that it was not secret, it was not confidential, okay, and that anyone who wanted to read it could read it. But I think you are right that I'm not sure it's our, that we should be the ones to spread it around.
I leaked it. I got it. It was not confidential. And I have talked with the president about this and made the strong representation that I thought that the university assembly was the appropriate body to begin discussions with us. Now, I think that if you turn it down, he'll probably find some other mechanism. But my feeling is that you have the perfect opportunity to begin this process. You have every right to do it because, as you point out, it's constitutionally yours. And I would not worry so much about consequences. I would go ahead and start with it. I would not publish it in the Daily Sun tomorrow morning in detail because I think it's going to make life just that much more difficult for everybody. But I do think it's perfectly legitimate to have all the members of the assembly have it, talk about it, and begin to go forward with it.
Perhaps it might not be a bad idea, not necessarily even calling it the Krause Report, but Since we now have this section of the Chronicle for University Assembly Business, perhaps it wouldn't be bad to indicate that the University Assembly is looking at the overall issue of the right now of the campus code, that maybe we could just refer to a report, okay, has been presented that would carry with it, were it adopted, substantive changes in the way that the code is administered or even that the code is formulated, and that your University Assembly is going to look into it. Maybe that would help to raise some awareness. What do you think? I think we all got something in email that said.
In terms of the Chronicle for this semester, what we're right, it's just the announcement of meetings. I think it's next semester when it starts off giving going on.
Well, something newsworthy, you know, at the leadership breakfast, they were looking for something newsworthy. They'd make space for it. But anything, I think we will look at the executive when we meet next week. We'll talk about formulating committee, and you'll definitely be on it, by the way. Yeah, you can't go this far without.
I also just think that I think that it's important to separate the code of conduct from the academic code of integrity. And if you're looking at both of them, I think that, I mean, when you move to act on them, they should be acted on. And just in regards to actually making it aware, people aware about that we're looking into the campus code of conduct, I mean, I think that it's perfectly, you know, I think that, you know, having a grounds for it is, I guess, a justifiable means to actually act on something. But I don't necessarily think that we should need that to actually implement and act on something. And, like, or, you know, a report to actually give us license to do so. And, I think that it seems that President Scorton seems to have a lot of faith in the assemblies this year. I mean, and I think that we don't necessarily, I just think that, you know, if we're going to discuss it, we should act on it as well.
No, that's, yeah. Assuming we still have the power to do it.
Well, it just seems, you know, even when, you know, you were discussing how you, like, 2-3 years ago, you had the discussions around the honor code and academic integrity beforehand, and yet absolutely nothing came of it. And I think that, you know, right now we are at a point where we actually do have the opportunity to do something, so.
Can I just, like, I mean, part of the thing with the honor code is that once we, in fact, got started, is that the president appointed Krauss to look at it, so we stopped. But I would, in fact, like to put the honor code and the academic integrity back on the table. Because, in fact, I think that would be great, that would also be a great discussion. We looked into, we told people on campus that we were looking into, you know, possibly recommending adoption of a corner-wide honor code. I think that would, you know, also attract opinions.
Well, why don't we draft something? We'll make that one of the things we do at the next meeting. Something to see about getting into the Chronicle. And I absolutely agree with what you're saying, and we will do that with people at committee. Randy?
Even though I said I think these two things would go together, that doesn't preclude doing them separately at all. But I do want to say that people may want to go to the VP for Financial Affairs website or the policy, I can't remember from my notes here, the Policy Advisory Office, or the Policy Advisory Group website, who would get this Krauss report kind of thing, because we would be an unnamed stakeholder in the whole flow chart that they have for how the Policy Advisory Group works. And it just seems they would have very different concerns. They set policy that has things to do with every aspect of the university. So, for example, I mean, they were going to build a windmill somewhere, and they were balancing building a windmill versus academic integrity or something. I think they'd come to different decisions than we would. And I think that website's a little scary. It being a little bit of a fear monger here.
I have to tell you, I've never looked at this website.
I sit on the Executive Policy Review Group, which is the final stage of this.
What's the acronym?
I see that is about right. And the Krauss report is nowhere near ready for that kind of thing. It needs to be discussed by the people that are involved, and I would certainly see that I could do everything I could to keep it out of the policy law until this group or some other group is finished and has been extensive discussion and and there's general agreement about the direction it ought to go. The policy people can then turn it into wonderful legalese language that none of us can understand and publish it in very small type on many pages and so on. That's what they do. And it's nowhere near ready for that.
Would anyone be opposed to, if we said by the November meeting, everyone read the Krauss report? If we emailed it out, would that be all right with everyone?
Is there anyone who doesn't have it?
We did get it.
Yeah,
I think it went out.
Our emails it out to everybody.
Let me know if you don't have it. I can do it again.
Okay. I just have a quick question. And that we've been talking about whether the academic integrity and the code of conduct should be separate or together. And it was just me, I'm just so confused how ZEMI, which is the educational environment part, is different from academic integrity, how those deal with separate issues. Because you mentioned that ZEMI deals with like cheating and plagiarism, medical excuses, and I'm just a little bit confused on how that's different from academic integrity.
Again, in my mind, part of it has to do with how you view the issue of academic integrity within the educational mission of the university. And now I'm speaking the way they were speaking in the CJC. And that was that when you talk about academic integrity, the way it reads in REMI is thou shalt not. A lot of thou shalt nots with all the things that will happen to you if you do this, and a whole judicial procedure for what you need to go through to prove your innocence and do all this. Very legalese. Academic integrity as a part of somebody's education should not necessarily always use the stick. You know, wait until you've done something wrong and then tell you what's going to happen to you. There should be an educational component to academic integrity that's not in the code. How do you not just tell people what will happen if they do not have academic integrity, but instill the principles of academic integrity into them? And that's not in REMI. And the feeling was that at least what I think the Krauss report was supposed to do, if it addressed academic integrity at all, or the whole code, was to not be so much this is what's going to happen to you when you're bad, you know, but basically how can we elevate you above even having to worry about what's going to happen to you if you're bad, because you're so pure and wonderful that it never comes up in the first place.
And that was one of the things that Professor Lehman was saying about the honor code, that one of the reasons, motivations we have to look at to sort of say that honor code can also be uplifted, that it isn't just sort of thou shalt not. It also talks about being in an academic community with respected of people, but also in a, you know, more even a positive way, and thought that maybe the honor code would in fact have that kind of impact. Because at some of the schools that have honor codes, there are people who take great pride in the fact that they have an honor code and that they can take exams that are self-scheduled because they know that they have that freedom and that, you know, people are not cheating. And if you, and, you know, you make that kind of community.
I wanted to do Leon, then I wanted to move on to one other thing.
So okay, I just wanted to mention real quick academic integrity, that I think perhaps it might be a little late after first-year students come here. I think that if we're going to do that, we might want to consider also regarding our recruitment materials and regarding our application. I think those are other avenues where things can be said and shared about who we are and what we want our student body to be, instead of just waiting until a student comes here doing an orientation that he or she may or may not attend to hear this information. So I think we should institutionalize it even before students arrive on campus.
You've been doing
what? Yeah. On the application.
Huh? On the essay, on the application.
On the essay. Yeah. Or even doing like alcohol EDU, but for...
Well, I was thinking of that, though, but I think that it would be most effective if you implemented within a system that's already in place,
rather than spending the money and creating a web, like a web tutorial or something along those lines? Because I know I've gone through the academic or the alcoholic EDU, and it's you try and just get it through it as quickly as possible, and students don't actually think about it.
So I think that way. I don't think a question on the application or in our recruitment material.
Yeah.
That's not spending.
I think a question on the application would be a great idea.
Or in our recruitment material.
Yeah.
I think if nothing else, I think that might help us attract a different type of student. Because some of the schools that do have honor codes, that do use it as a, this is what we're about, this is why this institution is a wonderful place.
You know,
right, I think that might create that type of environment.
And I think one of those things that kind of, I mean, maybe coming into Cornell, a lot of prospective students kind of feel the pressure to do so. And I'm a tour guide on campus too, and a lot of the one main questions I usually get is, well, Cornell is such a competitive place, how do people survive here? And that's a question I'm getting from a lot of prospective students and parents that come. And so if that's the attitude that people coming in with, then maybe that's a perception that we even need to address, and maybe doing something through the admissions process might be a way to do that as well. So I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
I was going to say, one of the questions on the application, essay questions sometimes is, what's one of the hardest things that you've had to go through in your life? And I always find those answers just inspirational. It's really inspirational. I admire, like, every incoming freshman after I read their my advisee after I read their application. So that type of question, which is a very difficult one, you know, what's one place where you really learned that I have to make this decision? So the honor vote, when I would have thought I didn't realize something or I didn't realize something.
Yeah, so sometimes it works. The vet school has a number of, I think it's 5 questions as part of the application that has to, you know, give briefly describe the situation in which you felt, you know, you were honorable or whatever. And the only problem is that they all involve, you know, euthanasia or Fluffy was sick and you took him to the vet, because they tell you what they think you want to hear. Okay, so actually reading through it and finding someone who generally genuinely tells you something that was inspirational that has nothing to do with them being a vet, you know, is really quite rare. But, I mean, I'm not sure that that's bad.
And also, and maybe Dean Walcott might have some information. I know that many years ago I went to a presentation. It was like, I guess, called Don McKay, who was out of the Ethics Center. And he did a survey of Cornell grad students, faculty, and students.
And undergrads.
And undergrads. And I went to this presentation about cheating and everything else. And one thing he did say is that when people go from high school to college, there is the expectation that if you teach in high school, that college at least should be a little more difficult and that you are less likely to cheat. But also people self-acknowledge that they still cheated at Cornell, and there were a number of recommendations and everything else. I know that maybe 2001, 2002, the presentation, so we could also get that kind of information that's probably dated now, but still information about his ethics center. And in fact, he also has an about Barry Thomas, who's an honor code.
And we are a member, so we can, if you wish, feel sure you can get him up here to talk with us again and help.
No, that's something the UA should sponsor, should ask to happen.
It's really an interesting question. I mean, one of the things that, you know, one of the examples is by major, which schools are more likely, which people are more likely to cheat by major. That if there was a science major where the perception was if you got 1B, you didn't have a future, then people might cheat more than people in other majors, or in fact, you talk about other universities where people who take exams, if you sit so close to each other, that again, you're more likely to cheat if you had test centers, where I think at BYU, everybody comes in to the central location to test, but everybody's taking different exams, and so you have no incentive to try to cheat off the person next to you. Just practical things like that can also change, you know, the culture at the university.
Okay, well, we have plenty to discuss at the next executive committee meeting for sure. It's late, and I wanted to at least get to this document about charter change, okay, which was a document just for discussion. Thank you very much for coming. Have fun with the trustees.
Thanks.
um, what I had hoped was that everybody would have a chance to read through this and come prepared to at least discuss the pros and cons, not worry about the numbering, not worry about the exact wording at this point. It's not, that's why it was not in form of a resolution. And it was purposefully done in reverse order because what is most important to tackle right now concerns the current way that the charter is written as regards your leadership or our leadership. The old code, and I put it here in section 3.1 and 3.2, says that there will be a chair and a vice chair elected, and these were separate individuals. I served on the UA when there were chairs and vice chairs. Maybe 4 years ago, reasons that were even a bit obscure in my mind, we moved to the idea of an executive committee, and in fact, the executive committee as such was entered into the charter under 3.6, and we have been operating really quite well as if 3.1 and 3.2 did not exist and only 3.6 existed. And the real issue is, do we want to continue with having an executive as the, I won't say governing entity, you know, but basically as the masthead of the UA. In other words, as it is currently written, basically there is one member from each of the four constituencies on the executive. I've added something about being elected by members of each individual constituency by simple majority. For the faculty, we went outside. We all looked around. There was a lot of pointing. We didn't feel that the person who wasn't there would do it, okay, and so somebody got it by default. However, it worked out, but the point is that each individual constituency put forward their member to be on the executive. And I guess the real question is, what is your feeling? Okay, if we drafted a resolution that basically read pretty much the way you see here, with the appropriate renumbering, and also going through the rest of the code and in the resolution changing any other sections that refer to chair and vice chair. Do people here have any problem with that?
I think it's a great idea. I think over the past couple of years it seems like it's worked very well. So my recommendation would be to continue. Within the draft, though, there's some, and before I get into this, I'll let other people comment, but I have a couple of recommended changes.
Oh, that's
great.
That's perfect. I mean,
that's what we want.
Yeah. So, go.
Do you want the other folks to comment first before I go into this?
Well, it seems to work very well. The individuals seem to get along, so that's a prerequisite. One can imagine cases where it might be very difficult, but that doesn't seem, if everyone's got goodwill here and there are only a few people involved, that, you know, you want to make it work.
Basically, our goal with like the executive meetings is to go over the charter and make the charter reflect what's actually been just going on for a while.
Yeah.
So,
Leon, maybe if it's okay, if you could submit those, and I'll disseminate to everybody because we only have 5 more minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
I just have 2.
Oh, questions. Okay. Then just I didn't know how many you had. Sure.
No,
just 2. Under 3.6.3.4.
Mm-hmm.
Any such statement by the executive committee shall be reported in full at the first meeting of the assembly following the vacation or mid-semester break. I think perhaps it should say, like, vacation or any break, because in case of a snowstorm hit and we were shut down or people couldn't get here or who knows, but I'm just saying, why limit it to just mid-semester breaks? There could be other things that could happen.
Fine.
So I'm just trying to make it general for any
a reason at all. That's what I was trying to say. So anyway, that's the recommendation. The other one on 2.1 on the next page, I wondered why students, it's only 1 year term for students and for everybody else it's 2 years. All members should serve 2 year staggered terms, which should be contained within their constituent assembly terms, except for student members who shall serve 1 year terms. I just wondered why that is. Does the SA only have like 1 year?
It offers seniors an opportunity to be on.
Yes, so maybe why couldn't it offer faculty and staff opportunities to serve as well? Why isn't it consistent? I mean, why just 1 year for one group and everybody else
for the continuity of the group?
Hmm?
For the continuity of the group, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that if you had the terms longer than that, seniors couldn't serve was the reason for the essay. The question is,
I don't want the terms longer. I just wondered why for one group 1 year and everybody else 2 years.
I think it was because the other group, you assumed that the people here were here for a longer period of time than the students. And that by having staggered terms, you'd have continuity from those constituencies.
Well, I guess if the students, I can't speak for them because I'm not, but if they're satisfied that 1 year terms is fine with them, it's fine with me.
Also, just another thing that we were discussing as an executive committee that you might want to think about is we're looking at reexamining the numbers of people on here so that we can start reaching quorum. And we couldn't really come up with a basis for why the numbers were the way they were, number of faculty, number of grads, etc. So that would be something to discuss at our next meeting and think about. Like, what do you think realistic numbers would be for that?
Okay. I have no other comments.
Actually, I mean, the numbers that you picked probably kind of pull out of hand. And I say that with all due respect. Yeah, I mean, that any number is kind of...
Well, as I say, there was no... I went and looked, okay, back through the books over in the assembly office, and it wasn't really clear how the numbers came about. So why were there 7 faculty and only 4 graduate students, right?
Not a Fibonacci series.
Okay. Well, it doesn't even fit a reasonable series. Now, of course, when you go back and you realize that much of the charter was written at a time when the university was trying to be responsive to shotguns on the stairs of the Strait, and a lot of aspects of the code, as with our recent Redbud thing, were done to basically quell dissent and give people what they wanted at the time in the hopes that a lot of it would just go away and disappear, which many parts of the UA charter have tended to do. I have been unable to find out why those numbers are there, but I'm sure at the time it was not done by guesswork. It was politically motivated. Okay? And we thought in discussing it that there was no reason why in this particular body, at least the employees, the graduate and professional students, and the faculty should not have equal representation. The question had to do with the undergraduates, and there was comment made that certain aspects of what the UA do may impact the undergraduates more, and the undergraduates may be less willing to, they should be more than equal. And this was something that was actually mentioned briefly in one of the things I read about the original assignation of numbers. So I just threw a number out. You know, as far as I'm concerned, 4, 4, 4, and 4 is just dandy. It makes it easier to get a quorum. But it really depends on what the undergraduates feel in terms of the UA. It was also noted that, and this is more practical, there was not a particular problem in getting people from the SA to be on the university assembly. So getting 7 names was relatively easy compared to getting, or was it six names, whereas getting 7 faculty never happened in recent memory.
Are there 7 colleges and schools?
Don't know. But you know, Jules is right that we really want to consider not just that kind of membership issue, but also the numbers. So I'd appreciate input.
Hmm? Well, I recall some of the votes in the past that made a big, big difference having to do with alcohol abuse. Those were close votes. And the students were definitely interested in that. And if they had had more members, it wouldn't have been close to alcohol. So actually, it's a significant thing. It's not just a for you. Students should think about that.
Okay.
But if we don't show up as faculty, it's
well, students are the largest population on any campus, Cornell included.
Unfortunately, what are them? How many staff and faculty members are there for undergraduates?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah. I can get it if you want.
That'd be great if we can get the numbers.
I think that also with the undergrad our students, I mean, faculty and employees are typically here for longer periods of time, and they feel the effects of the policies that are implemented more than the students do who leave after a certain period. So I think that that's another factor that also needs to be taken into account when you're figuring out the numbers. And then, I mean, it would be great to have, I mean, as an undergraduate, like, you know, you want more representation, but at the same point, I think that you guys feel the effects of the policies longer than we do.
Sort of ask you to stay another 3 minutes. Our official time has run out. That's okay? Yeah? Oh, okay, we'll go by that clock. Then we have 5 minutes.
Well, for some purposes for the faculty, I mean, you know, participating is one thing, but if we don't have seated members, isn't the forum only of members who are seated? So that if you have 7 faculty spots, they only seat 4 members of the faculty, the other 3 spots, that kind of gives you the quorum.
Well,
I think according to Robert's Rules of Order, depends on what you're trying to do.
That's right.
Because sometimes it depends on quorum of people you have, but for certain changes you need to make, especially if you're trying to make changes to charters and bylaws and things like that, a lot of times the quorum depends on the number of people you're supposed to have.
The full UA.
Right.
And then that's
going to
be a problem.
So.
That's why this is all coming in.
Okay.
We're never going to be bold again.
Lastly, for Article 1, and this was one where, you know, I just sort of rambled my own feelings there for comment. Article 1 is the one that, you say, gives us or gave us legislative authority over these entities. And in fact, we don't have legislative authority over them in reality at all. And the choices would seem to be just dispensing with that part of the code altogether, okay, and just forgetting that we have anything to do with them. Or what the executive in discussion felt would be more reasonable, and I'm speaking for myself in this. Okay, I put this forward, so I'm not speaking for the executive, although was proper, is that we should not sit back idly. We should realize that we can't legislate things, but that we should not abrogate what was given to us and simply ignore it, but rather we should insist that at least we're part of the decision-making process and that the president or whoever would actively have to ignore us if we were against something. As opposed to just bypassing us altogether. So, for example, I was just reading the resolution from the GPSA concerning parking changes. Okay. We didn't hear anything about this change before it happened, did we? Should have turned it off. Suddenly, there's flex parking. That was a policy issue change of an entity, Transportation and Mail Services, that belongs to us. We were told nothing about it before it happened. We were not part of the decision-making process. There was no chance for us to carry this back to our constituency. It just happened. Boom. That was ours. They didn't have the right to do that. Okay? But because, you know, they felt that, you know, why not? We're impotent anyway. They just walked around us. And I think that we need to reaffirm our power and at least say, you've got to let us know before these things are implemented. Okay? And when these reports are turned in to, I think your overseers is how I put it, okay, we have the opportunity to have input before the final decision is made. We may be ignored, you know. That's fine.
We may at least say
we have, you know, no feelings about this issue one way or the other. But we should come up with those kinds of things that we should definitely be informed about before they happen. Now, I don't think that, you know, theoretically, legislative authority, if they decided that they wanted to change the color of the parking stall paint from white to yellow, I'm sure there's some committee that does that. I could care less. You know, what computers they buy, you know, that is not up to us. Okay. But things like changing parking fees, designating lots for particular groups, those kinds of policy changes that affect the community, that's ours, and we're stupid if we let that go by without at least trying to gain some authority over it again. Sam?
She was first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that, you know, there should be reporting from other, you know, constituents, but they're not going to report to us until we reject them. And I think that you can't expect them to come to us until we say, I mean, with regards to transportation, if anyone's ever worked with transportation, they're extremely, they do what they need to do when they need to do it, and with whatever their circumstances of the transportation issues are, and without any really regard to anyone else. And so unless you force them to come to us, but we need to make that first step. And I think that's the case with the majority of departments within Cornell.
Yeah, oh no, I'm saying we have to be proactive. That means that we have to have active members again, okay? And we actually have to remind them, you know, that they have a responsibility. We don't have to go begging for scraps from them when they do this. We run things. And if they choose to do it, I'll be the first one at the Sun. You know, I'll be the first one in the president's office waving that charter and saying, don't you dare do this.
They're breaking campus
code.
They are. And on top of that, you know what you do? I'll tell you exactly what you do. Parents. You can get anything you want at this university if you get the parents to write to the president. I swear to God, that's the only thing that really... If your parents wrote over there and said, I went to Park, and I couldn't find a place to park. What goes on? Mark my words, parking things will change.
If you go down to that ultimately undermines their own power, so...
No, I'm being facetious, obviously, but yeah, this is something that's stuck in my throat for a long time. And I just do not think that we should let it be known that they must do this. And if they don't, okay, we're going to do something about it.
Just real quick, because I know our time is running out, but in your last sentence, it says, however, there would be political consequences if the UA were ignored. What would just be one example of that?
Students sitting in the president's office.
That's one example.
Yeah.
Like us going in.
Me, faculty. I always wonder why faculty don't sit in the president's office. In Vietnam days, we did it at UCLA.
We must be waiting for a chair.
Yeah. And they have good coffee over there, too.
Hopefully they would be tenured if they were going to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you could look over this and email recommendations. And what I'll do is try and formulate something that's more like a resolution that we can discuss and hopefully vote on. Yep.
Can I just ask a general question? What's the status on the committees? I know they
were supposed to be printed out and brought today. The assignments have been made. I'll email them out tonight, but they're supposed to be given out at today's meeting.
All right. When are they going to meet? Is that up to the chair of the
committee? Yep.
We're adjourned.
Somebody get a second.